into that text in just a moment. I promise, I threw this first slide up, and David said, "You're not going to cover all the wisdom literature tonight, are you?" And I said, "No." I said, I'm not. I'm just setting up. Matter of fact, we're not going to cover all of Ecclesiastes, so take a deep breath. It's going to be all right. You won't. I promise I will not preach till midnight. But we are going to concentrate on the first few chapters of Ecclesiastes. Again, we won't try to cover the entire book. The meat of what I would like to share with you tonight is found in those first few chapters. But let me set up the stage for the importance of the book of Ecclesiastes. If we take a look at the wisdom literature, and this is not an original thought to me, like many of my thoughts, they are borrowed. But somebody put this together, and I thought it was pretty brilliant and simplistic, and that's the reason I liked it, is that the wisdom literature of the Bible is the how-to part of the Bible. Now, there are a couple other places, obviously, that are how-to, but these are all how-to. And so we look at the book of Job, and it explains how a godly person would... It's how to suffer, how to suffer properly, and how to put suffering in perspective and look at it from the right way and recognize some of the mistakes that we can make in suffering. Psalms is really about how to pray. We might even expand that a little bit to how to praise in general. Proverbs, probably the most practical book of all of the Bible, is just how to live. I mean, it covers everything from marital problems to the work ethic to government to just all kinds of things. And I'll come back to Ecclesiastes in a moment. Song of Solomon, how to love. That's an important point. I don't hold that the Song of Solomon is an allegory for Christ and His church. I think Song of Solomon is exactly what you think it's about when you go to reading it. I think it's about exactly about a love affair between a man and a woman. And so Solomon is weighing in on that by saying, this is how romance is done amongst God's people. And then finally tonight, we're going to look at Ecclesiastes, and this is how to enjoy or how to have joy or how to find joy. And let me caveat, in a broken world that doesn't make sense when you look around you in any time. And look, it's been this way. We're going to concentrate on one passage in just a moment. But I do want to, in verse 9 of chapter 1, but I want to say this up front. Ecclesiastes is always applicable. Mm-hmm. But over the last few years, it sure seems that maybe we need to study it a little bit deeper and a little bit more. That maybe it would have more meaning because we are undergoing in the West a tremendous cultural upheaval. And there are a lot of people out there that are asking, what's it all mean? You know, if the government's going to lie to you and the stock market's going to crash and there's going to be a global pandemic over which I have absolutely no control, if there's going to be all of these other problems that I face, then what's the point? How can I even find meaning or purpose? How can I find happiness? How can I find joy? And we're going to investigate that tonight because I'm going to tell you something. That's a good question. Amen. It's a question I ask myself a lot. You know, it's a question I sit on the porch and I ponder a lot. Is what's the point? It is all meaningless. Well, we're not the first ones to ask those questions. They are old, ancient questions. And here, someone puts it on paper. Contemplating, he's thinking about it deeply. And so let's get into Ecclesiastes and think about how we can enjoy. This is a philosophical book, but it is also practical philosophy. It's something that all of us consider. The writer of this text is going to consider ideas like, why am I here? What's the meaning of life? Where is this all leading to? Why is life not fair? Why is life so difficult? Why do I have to suffer? Why is there injustice? And the list goes on and on. He's going to investigate these questions in the course of this book. Let's spend a few minutes kind of putting the book together and think about it. It's one of the most unique books in all of the Bible. One of the things that I'll point out as we go through this is a friend of mine described it like this, that Ecclesiastes is like walking through a field at night in a thunderstorm. You're kind of You're kind of bumbling your way through there. It's very confusing. And then every now and then there is a flash of lightning and you get your bearings on where you're going. And you can move again. And there are these islands of hope and faith in Ecclesiastes, where the writer seems like this burned out cynic who says, look man, life is meaningless. But then he will say, but you can work a little bit. You can have a family. You can accept these things as the gift of God, and you can have contentment, and you can have peace, and you can know these things that give us meaning in life. So he doesn't leave us hanging without answers. He does give us answers. The theme of the book, we'll talk about in just a moment, but generally, again, it's about enjoyment. I want to point out, I'm going to build on this in just a moment, but there are a couple of key words or key phrases. The most important one here for this idea is vanity. I'll build on this in just a moment. And then we're going to talk about the title of itself in just a moment. Let's talk about themes. There are two general themes that I think that are fleshed out in the book of Ecclesiastes. One is fear God. That's throughout in chapter 3, 5, 7, 8, and 12. Matter of fact, it's the conclusion. But it's an important thing that we understand this fear and what it means. We'll talk a little bit about that as we conclude our lesson. We're going to spend the bulk of our time on this second theme, eat, drink, and make your soul enjoy good of its labor. Now listen carefully, for this is the gift of God. This is about how we look at the world. You want to find meaning, or you want to find purpose, or you want to find mission in your life, in this broken world where there doesn't seem to be the right answers. We have to look at it through the right set of lenses. This is the way we perceive things. It's the perspective that we have. My good friend and mentor, Alan Yeager, made this point. He said, the study of Ecclesiastes provides a biblical definition of the relationship between Christ and culture. And I thought that was spot on. It is helpful to us to understand what is going on, the relationship between Christ and what goes on around us, because culture shifts under our feet, but Christ is consistent. And although maybe we are not completely protected from the bad things that happen in this life, what does Ecclesiastes help us do and our relationship with Christ? Navigate the tragedy. It gives us a mooring. It gives us a compass azimuth to get through the tragedy that faces all of us and all of the things that go with it. So we're going to concentrate on that second point. Eat, drink, make your soul enjoy good of its labor, for this is the gift of God. We're going to think a lot about that this evening. Here are two key phrases I want you to pay attention to. As a matter of fact, I'm a big Bible marker. If you are too, I always recommend drawing your attention to key phrases. 37 times in Ecclesiastes, in 12 chapters, 37 times, the Hebrew word hebel is used. Hebel is a breath or a vapor. That's its literal translation. Now, it's by metonymy, it can be fleshed out to mean other things. It can be fleshed out to mean things like futility or meaninglessness or fleeting, or empty, or worthless, or even deceitful. So tonight when he talks about vanity, he's making the point. He'll expand on that. He said it's like grasping for the wind. That is often coupled. That would be a third common theme that you see, or a common phrase, that he'll often couple that with that. And so he's considering the vanity of life. But this is the key point to Ecclesiastes, or one of them. We've got to understand what he's saying properly in its context. And the key phrase that helps us with that is under the sun. When he says life is meaningless under the sun, what he is saying is, you take God out of the equation, you got no explanations for why life has no purpose. That's an important point through all of this study. You'll never fully understand the depth of the book of Ecclesiastes if you don't get this point. When he says, vanity of vanities, all is vanity, and it is grasping for the wind, all that is under the sun, what he is saying is, everything this world can give you set apart from God, it's empty. It's going to mean nothing. And he's going to flesh that out, and we're going to talk a little bit about that in just a moment. Okay, real quick, let's talk about Solomon's name is never invoked in this text. There are indicators. He talks about being the son of David. He talks about being the king of Israel in Jerusalem. Obviously, that narrows it down. Matter of fact, it narrows it down to one dude. But he never uses his name. More importantly, he uses in Hebrew the name Koheleth. And all that means is the one who would speak before an assembly. And so in English, it is rendered the preacher. And really, as you'll notice, the Greek language, we have the Latinized version of the Greek word. And so Ecclesiastes in Latin means a preacher. And so we're going to stick with what we know. I don't think you'll catch me using Solomon. We're going to stick with what we know. There are four primary discourses. We're going to focus on the first one tonight. So in chapter 1 and 2, there is nothing new in life on the earth under the sun that can be depended upon for joy and fulfillment. All is vanity. That's the central part. That's the great message I want you to take away. I want you to think about that again. There is nothing new in life on earth that is under the sun that can be depended on for joy and fulfillment. All is vanity. It is empty. It's fleeting. And so again, we'll flesh that out in just a moment. We're not going to concentrate on the other discourses tonight just for the sake of time. I am taking a 12-week series of lessons and bringing it down to one single lesson. But I will say I enjoy this first part because it is the heart of this. So let's concentrate on this first discourse. So let's think a little bit about how he organizes this and how he builds on this letter. Join me in Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verse 1. The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Vanity of vanity, says the preacher. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? A generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises and the sun goes down and hastens to the place where it rises. The wind blows to the south and goes around to the north. Around and around goes the wind, and on its circuit the wind returns. All streams run to the sea, but the sea is not full. To the place where the streams flow, where they flow again. All things are full of weariness. A man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. What has been is what will be, and what has been done is what will be done, and there is nothing new under the sun. Is there a thing of which it is said, see, this is new? It has been already in the ages before us. There is no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of latter things yet to be among those who come after. I'm going to tell you something. That is a sad start to any letter. That is a sad start to any book. You know, that's one of the starts to, that's one of the beginnings of the book where you're not sure you want to keep going. This fellow got deep real quick. He got dark real quick. And basically is convincing us life is meaningless. It doesn't mean anything. And he even invokes nature. He said, look at nature. He said, sun's going to go down tonight. I know what's going to happen. Sun's going to come back up tomorrow. What's it going to do? It's going to take the same track across the sky. It's going to go down again. And he says, I even know what's going to happen to the waters of the earth. It's all going to end up back at the head of the holler and the head of the stream, and it's going to come back down. Ecclesiastes chapter 1 and verse 9, I think the most significant of this. What has been is what will be, and what has been done, and what has been done is what will be done, and there is nothing new under the sun. And he goes on to ask the question, is there anybody who can show me something that's new? Now look, don't get me wrong, I get it, and the preacher gets it too. There are new technologies and all that thing. But he's thinking philosophically. There's nothing new. I'm kind of a historical guy. My mind works like that. And I don't like it. I hear this all the time in the news, and it's getting worse every day. I hear it all the time. It is unprecedented. Unprecedented this and unprecedented that and unprecedented the other thing. You know what? There's almost nothing unprecedented in human history. Almost nothing. The preacher's right. It's happened again. We, everyone, realize it. If you think something's unprecedented, You need to read more books. Read good history. Because what you'll soon find is, as Mark Twain said, history may not repeat itself, but it sure does rhyme. We just don't learn our lesson from history. The German philosopher Hegel made the greatest point about history that there was. He said the only lesson that we learn from history is that we don't learn history. And so, he's right. Look, every one of us has been in a place in our life where we could have written the first 12 verses of Ecclesiastes. What's the point? It's vanity. He's making the observation. All you're going to do is work and you're going to get nowhere. And look, to be fair, every one of us understand that. We look around and say it's a rat race. We're on a treadmill. I get up on Monday morning and it's Groundhog Day. And it's the same all week. And I do the same job. And maybe you're in a job that has some meaning. Maybe you're not in a job that has meaning. And he gets that. He recognizes that it's easy for us to begin to think, well, there's nothing here. It's an empty life. But again, he begins that key phrase in verse 3, under the sun. That's the lens that he's looking at through. He's looking at it from the standpoint, if you take God out of the equation. So let's think a little bit more of what he will continue. So now if you'll notice in verses 12 through 18, he makes this point. So David read this for us a moment ago. He says, I, the preacher, have been king over Israel and Jerusalem, and I applied my heart to seek and search out by wisdom all that is done under heaven. It is an unhappy business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. I have seen everything that is done, again, under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and striving after wind. What is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be counted. I said in my heart, I have acquired great wisdom, surpassing all who were over Jerusalem before me, and my heart has had great experience of wisdom and knowledge. And I applied my heart to know wisdom, and to know madness and folly. I perceived that this also is but a striving after wind. For in much wisdom is much vexation, and he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. Pretty cynical, huh? Sounds like a pretty burned out old guy. And he goes on to make the point, I'm going to conduct an experiment. I'm going to try to figure this out for you. Now, whether he woke up one morning and said, I'm going to try to figure this out for you and I'm going to conduct this experiment, or whether, and I think it's this, what I'm getting ready to explain, or whether it is toward the end of his life and he is looking back on his life and he is saying, I had set my heart on those things. I'm sharing that with you now. I think Ecclesiastes is probably the wisdom of an elderly man down the road, almost at the end of his life, reflecting back on his life, telling those who are willing to read history, good history, that here's what you can expect. I'm going to give you some advice. I've tried the things, and that's what he's really setting up. He's saying, I set my heart, we're going to come back to that idea, heart, in a moment. I set my heart on these things. I looked at the things, and the things that he chases that we're going to elaborate on in chapter 2, the things that he chases are the things that we all chase. It is fun and pleasure and career and work and money and accomplishment and achievement. It's all of the things that down to today, it's the same thing that we're trying to chase. And I'll go ahead and tell you bottom line up front, as you might perceive, he's saying meaningless. If you are under the sun, if you view it from the standpoint without it being a gift of God, you're never going to find meaning in these things that humans chase for meaning. Let's talk a little bit about this word heart. Verse 13 and verse 17. Let's think a little bit about the word heart. The Hebrew term here, we would literally understand to mean the center of one's inner life. It deals with mind, it deals with will, it deals with emotion. Be very careful that we do not define it in simply emotional terms. That's a mistake. That's not what he's saying. We recognize, every one of us, and if you're a parent, you've probably given this advice, or if you're a kid, or if you don't have your own children, your parents probably gave you this advice. We give this advice all the time. I've given it to my children. I've made this mistake. We say, don't make an emotional decision. In other words, you know, as is my, I try this policy anyway, don't go to the grocery store hungry. You know, they tell you not to do that because you come home with Little Debbie cakes and Yoo-Hoo. And you eat them kind of, in the buggy on the way back to the car, you know, because you're hungry, and you get there and say, well, that was wasted money and calories, and I feel worse about it, you know. So don't go to the grocery store hungry. We also say don't make decisions when you're emotional. Don't make decisions when you're mad. Don't make decisions when you're frustrated, when you're upset, when you're disappointed. Take a deep breath, walk away, detach yourself, maybe even solve the problem, and then step back and say, okay, I'm gonna try this. We're going to look at it from a different perspective. But we do say, we tell people all the time, don't make emotional decisions, but we do say make heartfelt decisions. What do we mean? We're not necessarily telling them to make emotional decisions. We're trying to explain to them this connection between the intellect and the will, the mind, reason, as well as the dwelling place of our being itself. Let's do a couple of passages. 1 Samuel 16, chapter 16, verse 7. Samuel has gone to anoint David as the king, and God reminds him before he goes in and anoints him. He says, the Lord looks at the heart. Well, we know what it's not. We know it's not the blood pump. That's not what he's talking about. We know it's not just the intellect. It's not the mind as we understand the mind. But it's also not just the emotions. It's something else. He looks at the heart. Listen carefully to 1 Kings chapter 3 and verse 9. Now this is Solomon. So now we're getting a little closer to our study tonight. If you'll recall, the Lord asked Solomon, what do you want? He became king. He said, what do you want? What can I give you? And Solomon demonstrated his wisdom already. 1 Kings 3, 9, this is the New King James Version. Give to your servant an understanding heart. The English Standard Version says, give to your servant an understanding mind, and they both mean the same thing. When we start talking heart in spiritual terms, it's the nexus. It's where intellect and will and consciousness and emotion all come together. It's where it meets. We're not going to try to take those things apart into their individual part. It's a combination of all. But I will tell you, the intellect is a large part of it. We can't leave that out. If we leave that out, we're it's kind of like we talked about on Thursday night. We're only as good a disciple as our last tragedy. We're going to fold. If we're obeying God out of emotion, we're not going to last. So remember that as we think about what he made. When he says, I set my heart, it's not an emotional thing that he's doing. It's actually an intellectual pursuit. He's trying to figure this out. In other words, what he's saying is, I set my identity. I set my life. It's who I am. I set my identity to find these things out. Now let's think a little bit about what that experiment gleaned. If you'll notice chapter 2, verses 1 through 11. So let's see how he starts. I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with pleasure. Enjoy yourself. But behold, this also was vanity. I said, of laughter it is mad, and of pleasure what use is it? I searched with my heart how to cheer my body with wine, my heart still guiding me with wisdom, and how to lay hold on folly till I might see what was good for the children of man to do under heaven, again, under the sun, this would be the idea, during the few days of their life. So he starts with fleshly pleasure. There's probably, I'm not going to poll the audience, so I'm not going to embarrass anybody, but I'll share my story. There was a time in my life when I fell away from God and I tried that. I decided I was going to do what I wanted to between about the ages of 18 and 25. Developed real close to alcoholism in my life. And I just decided, looks like fun from where I'm standing, I'm going to give it a whirl. And in just a little while, I'd almost ruined the most important relationships in my life. I had ruined my reputation. I had ruined my father's name. I can speak where the preacher is speaking to this very, very intimately. And he was right. It's madness. It's folly. You'll find a lot of happy drunks. You won't find a lot of happy alcoholics. You won't find a lot of people the morning after who are happy about what they did the night before. It's nothing but tragedy. Solomon made the point, I gave in to wine, women, and song. And it was meaningless. It won't define your life. It won't bring you meaning in life. It won't explain anything. All it will do is bring you instantaneous joy for a moment, and then heartbreak follows. And so Solomon, there I did. I skipped. Made a mistake, man. Made a mistake. So the preacher said, don't do that. Avoid that. It's not going to bring you what you think it's going to bring you. It's not going to give you happiness. It's not going to give you meaning. It's not going to explain life. All it's going to do is bring more tragedy. So he experimented with that, gave his heart over to that. Another thing he did that is common amongst we humans is the idea of the vanity of wisdom and folly. Notice verse 12. So I turned to consider wisdom and madness and folly. For what can the man do who comes after the king? Only what has already been done. Then I saw there is more gain in wisdom than in folly, and there is more gain in light than darkness. The wise person has his eyes in his head, but the fool walks in darkness, and yet I perceive that the same events happen to all of them. Then I said in my heart, what happens to the fool will happen to me also. Why then have I been so very wise? And I said in my heart that this is also vanity. For of the wise as of the fool, there is no enduring remembrance, seeing that in the days to come all will have been long forgotten. How the wise dies just like the fool, so I hated life, because what is done under the sun was grievous to me, for all is vanity and striving for the wind. Now remember, so let me set this up for you. Make sure you understand this properly. Remember the context in which and the perspective in which he's viewing life. He's viewing it under the sun, separated from God. He's not suggesting in any way, shape, or form that godly wisdom taught by the Word of God is worthless. That's not his point. That's not what he's saying. As a matter of fact, this letter is filled with that. So he's not saying there is no wisdom out there that should be followed and one philosophy is just as good as another. It's not his point. He is saying this. If you think extra learning, academia, a degree, education, smarts, however you want to put it, intellect, wisdom, knowledge, if you think that can fill the hole that is in your being, in your heart, you can forget it. Because it's going to drive you nuts trying to figure it all out, because the books are not going to give you the answer. If you are looking at life under the sun. Now, conversely, he will teach elsewhere, godly wisdom is of great value. That's worth digging into. Because now you're not looking at life under the sun. Now you're not looking at life devoid of a relationship with God. And now you can get to know this wisdom and get to understand it. And so again, when we seek for education and when we seek for all of these things, if we don't understand this properly and keep them in perspective, it'll come back to us. A good friend of mine who went to college with me the first time a few years ago, I started another graduate program at the college where actually I went to undergraduate work near our hometown. And I was talking to a buddy of mine, catching up with him, and we had been students together as college students in my undergraduate work. And he said, what are you up to? And I said, I'm going to grad school. And he said, why are you doing that? And I said, well, you know, needed a new challenge, needed a new adventure, had to use my VA benefits. I gave him all kinds of excuses. And he says, I sure hope you're going to be a better student this time than you were last time. And I have been. I've got a 3.8 grade point average going right now. That's pretty good. I had a 2.0 grade point average the first time I was there and spent 4 semesters on academic probation. So I've done okay. I've grown up and matured since then. But I will tell you something. People keep asking me, what are you going to do with that degree? And I keep telling them, I don't know. Not sure. I enjoy the research. I'm kind of bookish anyway. I kind of enjoy that stuff. But I'm like, I don't know. I don't get too wrapped up into it now. It doesn't mean that much. I recognize, you know, well, I'm not going to explain life by getting another degree. I'm not going to figure out the most difficult things that I can think of by getting another degree. And so we need to keep these things, obviously, in perspective. Chapter 2, verse 18 and 23. And he also mentions this in verse 4 down, down through verse 10. But this is very similar. Verse 18. Now remember, if indeed this is who we think it is, who we understand it to be, he was a great builder. As a matter of fact, his father was a warrior, he was a builder. And so he spent most of his 40-year reign building things. Verse 18. I hated all my toil, in which I toil under the sun, seeing that I must leave it to the man who will come after me. And who knows whether he will be wise or a fool. Yet he will be master of all for which I toiled and used my wisdom under the sun. This also is vanity. So I turned about and gave my heart up to despair over all the toil of my labors under the sun. Because sometimes a person who has toiled with wisdom and knowledge and skill must leave everything to be enjoyed by someone who did not toil for it. For also, this also is vanity and a great evil. What has a man from all the toil and striving of heart for which he toils beneath the sun? For all his days are full of sorrow, and his work is a vexation. Even in the night his heart does not rest. This also is vanity. And we could go back and read chapter 2 and verse 4 down through verse 10, and it's a very similar theme. What's he saying? This man who built some great, enormous things that were just heralded in his day. He oversaw the building of his own royal complex. He oversaw the building of the northern part of Jerusalem and the Temple Mount itself. And he says, looking back on all of that, I worked myself to death and I'm going to leave it to children who won't appreciate it. And the truth is, if you've got children, or if you've got parents, you understand this. We realize it. We know. Sharon and I, when we first moved back home when I left the Army, it was amazing to us how much the home place had grown up. And we would go around and we would say, you know, we used to sled in that field, it's a subdivision now, and we used to go over here, we used to do that. And everybody kind of sits back and laments the demise of the American farm, folks. It's been happening since the beginning of the time. Just because Dad was a farmer doesn't mean the son wants to be a farmer. Just because Dad was a doctor doesn't mean the son wants to be a doctor, does it? Just because Dad lived in one place and made a nice house and built something and left the legacy he thinks behind doesn't mean that the son is going to appreciate it. Solomon realized all this and says, vanity, man. I've worked myself to death all of my life. And so he recognizes the vanity of toil. Now I will tell you that doesn't mean that he doesn't see the value of work. He's going to speak on that a little bit later on. Then in chapter 2 and verse 24, he comes to a conclusion. And this is one of those islands of hope and faith. In verse 24, there is nothing better for a person than that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. This also I saw is from the hand of God. For apart from him, who can eat or who can have enjoyment? For to the one who pleases him, God has given wisdom and knowledge and joy, but to the sinner he has given the business of gathering and collecting, only to give to one who pleases God. This also is vanity and striving out after the wind. Now understand this carefully. This is the perspective moment. This is when he is going back and he is saying, there's nothing necessarily wrong with some of these things that I have mentioned. There's nothing wrong with laughter and mirth. There's nothing wrong with wisdom and education. There's nothing wrong with working. There's nothing wrong with those things, if indeed we view them through the proper lens. And the lens that we view them through is, this is a gift from God. This is what God has blessed me with. I can find contentment. I can find meaning in this relationship that I have with God. I don't have to figure these other things out. And I don't have to find identity in my work or in my family or in my bank account or in the degrees that hang on my wall. I don't have to find identity there because I have identity with the Almighty. And if I've got that, that can now bring meaning to these other things. But if I try to find meaning in these other things under the sun without God, it's just going to come up a really frustrating exercise in futility. We're just going to keep trying to figure out. That's what Solomon did. So understand, he's not negating these things. He is not coming back and preaching a doctrine of, hey, just sit on the porch and wait till the end of time. That's not his point. I'll go ahead and tell you, work's good for you. God made you to be productive. God made you to be active. It's not good for you to sit on the porch. A retirement age is coming up for me. And there was a time when I thought, man, I can't wait. You know, a lot of, when we were younger, I was burning it at both ends when I was a younger man. I said, I can't wait till I retire. I'm just going to do whatever I want to. I'm getting close to that day, and I realize I'm not wired to just do whatever I want to. I don't idle well. I need some reason to be up tomorrow morning. It's good for all of us to have purpose. That doesn't mean you have to work in your job until you die at your desk. That's not my point. But if we retire from one job, we need to find some other purpose to keep going and keep hammering away. We're made for activity. We're made to function. We're made for action. And we have to throw some rest in there as well. But that's not what he's saying. He's not saying don't accomplish things. He's not saying don't get an education. He's not saying don't try to develop wisdom. He's not saying don't try to make money. He is saying you better see it in the proper perspective. If you see it as a gift for God, you can enjoy it deeply. Don't get me wrong. An atheist who has $1 million will enjoy it a little bit for a little while. But it's not going to bring deep meaning to him. Somebody who is in a right relationship with God, who has the things of this world, is going to have a proper perspective about it and be able to understand it properly. So understand, God really isn't mentioned that much in these sections. But we understand what he's saying. A difference in the perspective and the valuation of the wisdom of man versus God's. That's really what is under consideration in a lot of this. Are we looking at it from a human perspective? Or are we looking at it from a divine perspective? How are we looking at this? If we're looking at it through God's lens, we'll get it right. And an accomplishment like a degree can mean something. Or we can bring meaning to our job. No matter what that job is, it doesn't make any difference what it is. We can bring meaning to it. We can make it meaningful. Because I showed up and I did it with my might. Doesn't make any difference what it is. But it is this section, this first discourse, is considering the difference between a divine perspective and a human perspective. And in effect, he's telling us, look, we're getting it wrong because we're trying to find meaning in places there is none. The previous section ended in anguish, but not here. You will notice as it bleeds over into chapter 3, and I'm going to finish with just a few passages from chapter 3 and beyond real quickly. But now he is starting to use words like enjoyment and beauty and enjoy. So this is one of those islands of faith and hope. A lot of others in Ecclesiastes. But this is one of those places where he's looking at it and he's saying, look at what I found. You can have some of these things, but if you view them properly, they will bring you some joy. They will bring beauty. And you can enjoy the gift that God has given you. Let's look at a couple of these key passages, and then the lesson will be yours. In chapter 3 and verse 1, there is this idea, for everything there is a reason and a time for every matter under heaven. The birds didn't write that. God did. And so he makes the point, there are cycles. There's a time to be born and a time to die, plant, pluck what is planted, kill, heal, break down, build up, weep, laugh, so on. And so he's making the point, look, life has, we talked a little bit about this last night. For every Mount Carmel, there's a broom tree. There are ups, there are downs, it's a cycle. Sometimes you're up, sometimes you're down. Sometimes everything's going well, sometimes things are not. In verse 9 of chapter 3, what gain has the worker from his toil? I've seen the business that God has given to the children to be busy with. He has made everything beautiful in its time. Also, he has put eternity into man's heart. Yet so that he cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end, I perceive that there is nothing better for them than to be joyful and to do good as long as they live. Also, that everyone should eat and drink and take pleasure in his toil. This is God's gift to man. Real quick, let me sum that up in some important points. Chapter 3 and verse 11, I believe, is one of the key points of the book. He says he has put eternity in their hearts. Do you know why? When anthropologists over the years have found cultures and societies that have been completely isolated from Western civilizations, they find commonly two things that are common to them: a religion and a family structure. Without any instruction, they figured it out over time. A religion and family structure. What's the preacher's point? You are coded DNA to be spiritual people and think about eternity. We're coded that way. We can't not do it. Oh, let me tell you something. We can push it to the edges. We can try not to think about it. We can avoid it. We can distract ourselves. We can put it off. We can procrastinate. But every one of us asks the questions, what's it all about? Where's this going? What's next? And the preacher is demonstrating that. And then what does he say in verse 12? There's nothing better for them than to be joyful and to do good as long as they live. You know, the preacher, similar to Confucius, it's not about the destination as much as it is about the journey. He's saying, quit toiling for these things. Enjoy what God has given you. Don't play the victim. Take the good things that God has given you in this life. Recognize that they are precious, even when they are challenging. And he goes on to make the case throughout the remainder of the book, in these islands of hope and faith, where he is reminding the reader, enjoy your family. Find joy in your work. See it as a gift of God, something that you can help someone with. Because the good and the bad are going to walk through death. We all end up in the same place. As a matter of fact, he gets low in one point that he makes the point, there's nothing different between us and the animals. We all go back to the dirt. And in a physical sense, he sees that reality. But along the way, in these points of hope, he is reminding us, if we see this the proper way, if we see this through a lens with a relationship with God, what we can do is we can find joy in very simple things. As this is my favorite book of all of the Bible. I have spent a lot of time in Ecclesiastes, not so I could teach other people about Ecclesiastes, but so I could try to figure things out for myself. Because in many ways, I'm like this preacher. I've struggled to try to find meaning and identity in things other than my relationship with God. I wrestled when I retired from the military because my identity was wrapped up in that. That was who I was. That was my life's goal. That was my life's work. That was what I cannot remember a time in my life when I did not want to be a soldier. And on 28th of September, 2016, I signed out of my unit, got in my car, and drove off base. And it was over with. No party, no parade, no ceremony, and I got my retirement medal in the mail 6 weeks later. If I had called my desk the next day, they would not have known who I was. And I was like, huh, what am I supposed to do now? That's been me all of my adult life. What am I supposed to do now? Where do I find purpose? That was the whole reason for my existence. What am I supposed to do now? Well, I'll tell you what you do. You find meaning in the simple blessings that God has given you. I looked around and I said, I have a wonderful wife who has been my bride for many, many years. I have children who love me. I have grandchildren. My children are done. What I got is what I got. I got four of them, then no more, no more. But my grandchildren are growing. Number 10 shows up in January. I have something that God has given me to do, and a little bit of talent, I hope, to be able to do it. But you're the same. There's no difference. You also have things that God has blessed you with. You have things that give your life meaning. Most of us in this room are not going to be the George Washingtons and the Martin Luther King Juniors and all of the other people who will be remembered for many, many years. For most of us, the people who will remember us are our children and our grandchildren and our close friends. We have a dear friend at home who used to work at a funeral home, and he made the point to me one time. I was asking him, I said, where are you intending on being buried? He said, I don't care where they bury me. Because he said, working in a funeral home, I've learned this. He said, your grandchildren are the last generation who's going to come to see your grave until somebody 200 years from now is searching out their family genealogy. So he said, I don't care where they plant me. What was his point? What we've got in this life is pretty fleeting. And so we need to enjoy the journey as we travel toward our home in heaven. And see that all of these things that God gives us as a blessing from Him. And maybe now we can enjoy the things that previously didn't bring us any meaning. Thanks so much for your kind patience tonight. This is really a great book. I would encourage you, dig into the book of Ecclesiastes, all of the wisdom literature. But Ecclesiastes can really, I believe, bring some clarity at a time when so many people are wrestling. And look, let me share this with you real quickly too. We don't think much about Ecclesiastes being a source of evangelism for people, but it is. Because I'm going to tell you something. There's a lot of people out there who have never cracked open a Bible. They've never given much thought to God, that have all of the questions that this preacher has asked on their mind. They're asking these questions. And I will tell you, particularly younger generations in the culture in which we live right now are asking them a lot. And they're trying to do what he did and find them in the wrong places. They're trying to find them in political movements. They're trying to find them in social justice movements. And not that those things are not admirable, but that's not going to bring meaning to your life. They're trying to find it in all of the things that are going to come up empty. He has the answer. He's given it to us. So we can use this as a form of evangelism. Thanks again for your time tonight. Tonight, if somebody is here and has not obeyed the gospel of Christ, we're going to offer you that invitation. It's relatively simple. The New Testament, the early apostles, brought people to faith in Christ through teaching. And the Apostle Paul makes this point, but also Peter does, is that faith is an intellectual exercise. It's reading the Word of God and beginning to understand it, and based on that you have faith that not only that God exists, but also that Jesus is His Son, that He came, that He died, and that He started this new movement. He began this covenant. He ratified it. And we have hope through that. And so we have faith, and that we're willing to turn our life around. It's not that I'm going to say, okay, Lord, I want the warm, fuzzy feeling of eternal salvation, but I've got I want to come to it on my terms, not on yours. That's not what repentance is. Repentance says, Lord, I'll do it your way. Whatever you ask, I'll do it your way. Even if it's a bitter pill to swallow, I'll do it your way. Then he asked us that we confess, that we say out loud in public, I believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God. And then the demarcation is our immersion in water. And all that is symbolism of a death of one and a resurrection of another, just like Jesus died and was resurrected. And then, as Paul puts it, we go on to walk in newness of life. We're something new. We've had a transformation. We've got new properties. If you're here tonight and you've not done that, you're willing to do that based on your faith in God, we'd ask that you come while we stand together.